From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Who is Barack Obama?
That's a question asked repeatedly in the waning days of this election season by the McCain campaign. Millions have been watching Obama, studying Obama, for nigh on to 20 months. But the McCain campaign says that we don't know him, and that makes him
too risky for America.
Vincent Williams writes the social studies column for the Baltimore City Paper, and he's been writing about what many claim is the subtext for this charge of unknowability, that Obama is unknowable to some Americans because Obama is black. Vince, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So what do you think these ads are trying to do?
Well, I think they're trying to really feed into this notion that even though Barack Obama has been on the public stage generously 2 years, certainly since 2004, that there is still something unknown about him.
How do you think race plays into this idea of Obama as the other?
Well, I think oftentimes when you're addressing issues of race, unknown is just code for other. So that no matter how much information you may have about a black person, they are still unknown. Conversely, Sarah Palin, who a couple of months ago when she was introduced, almost immediately code was being put forth that she's one of us, she's a hockey mom, she's regular, when we really knew not much about her. Even at this point, I don't know how much we know about Sarah Palin, and frankly, I don't know how much it matters to people.
One thing we do know about Palin is that she's been the pit bull with lipstick spreading far and wide this notion that Obama is not like us.
This is not a man who sees America as you and I do.
She said that at campaign event after campaign event. And we have a video. We got it from YouTube this week. It was a cameraman who went around at a Palin rally asking people.
When's the first time you heard of Sarah Palin?
About a month and a half ago.
When's the first time you heard of Barack Obama?
About a year ago.
But you do believe you know Sarah Palin better than Barack?
I think there's been a lot more personal interviews with Sarah than there has been with Barack.
When's the first time you heard of
this
Sarah
year.
Palin? This year. When's the first time you heard of Barack Obama?
This year.
You sure about that?
Yeah.
Because he's been running for president for 2 years.
Not familiar with him.
What is most interesting about that video is just how visceral the dislike is for Barack Obama. I know at one point the cameraman asks one of the women at the rally, do you think Obama is a terrorist?
Do you think he's a terrorist?
Definitely. He's got the bloodlines.
What does that mean?
Just think about it. Look at the name.
It really does get to the level of biology.
You know, back in June, the neoconservative magazine, The Weekly Standard, said, quote, it is a sure bet that the GOP will try to paint Obama as the other, as a haughty black intellectual who has Muslim roots. And you wrote in your column in the City Paper that you were sort of bitterly amused by some of the strategies Team Obama has had to employ over the past few months to counter those impressions.
I call it the Norman Rockwell strategy. If you look at the convention in totality,
the Democratic National Convention,
the Democratic National Convention, the message shifted from change to he's regular. So much time was spent talking about Barack Obama's biography as a father and as a husband and as part of the community. If you look at the amount of time that Michelle and his daughter spent on camera and on stage with him.
You are unbelievable, and
you
also look very cute.
Thank you.
That's Sasha.
And listen,
I thought it was very much part of this strategy to have America accept him. There's no room for a black man on a national stage to be a rascal like Bill Clinton.
Not to mention the pregnant teenage daughter.
There certainly could not be a pregnant teenage daughter anywhere near Barack Obama.
You said that during this whole brouhaha lately over Barack's otherness, you happened to be watching an old DVD of the second season of The Cosby Show. You saw some parallels there.
I think one of the revolutionary things, certainly about the first two or three seasons, was that it really was plotless. it was almost a documentary of black normalcy. But because we had never seen that before, it was revolutionary. And one of the continuing challenges for African Americans, and particularly the African American middle class, is to be seen as run of the mill. That is the revolutionary brass ring right there.
This campaign soon will be history. How do you think it's contributed to what we in the media like to call the national conversation about race?
I think we're all a lot more articulate about race. And I think that's going to be a conversation in particular that's going to continue regardless of what happens in the election. There will be this ongoing engagement into what does it mean that Sarah Palin is invited to the club immediately and Barack Obama works so hard to. You know, what does that say about our definitions of normal?
Vince, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Vincent Williams writes the social studies column for the Baltimore City Paper.
In short, who is the real Barack Obama?
In the second presidential debate this week, candidates McCain and Obama were both asked who they might name as Treasury Secretary. Both candidates, not surprisingly, mentioned Warren Buffett. The Oracle of Omaha is said to be the richest man in the world, and with the economy tanking, consulting the Oracle seems to make good business sense.
But Warren Buffett is someone who, when he talks, the markets listen.
I mean, he's always the man to follow in this kind of market.
So someone who is wiser than any of us on the markets.
Can you imagine anybody better?
But what's he doing as the world waits? He's shopping. He drove a hard bargain for a chunk of Goldman Sachs and then this week picked up $3 billion worth of GE. Main Street, the story goes, is angry with Wall Street fat cats who ruthlessly raked in the cash. But nobody resents Buffett's billions. It's not part of the narrative, and nobody knows that narrative better than Alice Schroeder, formerly of Wall Street, now out with a massive book called The Snowball, Warren Buffett and the Business of Life. Alice, welcome to OTM.
Thank you, Brooke.
So let's begin by listening to Warren Buffett on Charlie Rose. Basically here, he's giving the bailout what amounts to the good housekeeping seal of approval.
We have a terrific economy. It's like a great athlete that's had a cardiac arrest, you know, and it's flat on the floor, and the paramedics have arrived, and, you know, they shouldn't argue about whether they put the resuscitation equipment, you know, a quarter of an inch this way or a quarter of an inch that way, or they shouldn't start criticizing the patient because he didn't have blood pressure tests or something like that. They should do what's needed right now, and I think they will, incidentally. I think the Congress will do the right thing.
I think the media has looked to him to play an official public role as some sort of job, and he doesn't want a job. He doesn't like to show up with regular hours or a schedule. So the talk of him becoming Treasury Secretary is nonsensical. He thinks of himself as a teacher and advisor, someone who's telling Americans what they need to know about the situation. But for Berkshire Hathaway shareholders, he's strictly in it to make money.
You know, it's funny, though, when you talk about him being a teacher, his quotables are rather oracular. You know, he said, "Only when the tide goes out do you discover who's been swimming naked." And he also hates people who trade back and forth. He likes to hold on to stocks for a long time. So he said, "We believe that according the name investors to institutions that trade actively is like calling someone who repeatedly engages in one-night stands a romantic."
Yes, he thinks in little parables and he has great aphorisms, and that's part of what's made him so popular. And he's somebody who does care about what happens to the United States and is very involved behind the scenes politically, but he doesn't invest altruistically.
He seems practically perfect in every way, just like Mary Poppins.
Warren is a very complicated person, and there's a separation between the tough, steely businessman, the dependent, needy person who needs a lot of support from people, and especially women in his personal life, and then the oracle, who really is somebody who's sought out by politicians and the media to give his wisdom in public during a time of crisis like this.
And he's said to have two wives? What's that story about?
When his wife, Susie, moved to San Francisco in 1977, looking for a broader life, essentially she split the role of a wife with her friend Astrid Mengs.
Okay. You know, there was an interesting piece in the New York Times last weekend comparing Buffett to J.P. Morgan. Do you agree? Is he the Morgan of today's crisis?
Well, the roles that they're playing are very different. J.P. Morgan was more like the Hank Paulson. He directly brokered the bank's solution to solving the panic of 1907. Warren, first of all, is investing and making money off of this for Berkshire shareholders, but he's also giving advice. And people have come to him and asked him to intervene directly on their behalf, for example, and go to the Treasury and lobby for, and he's declined to do that. So he's not playing a direct role.
Do you think that he's the Rockefeller?
Well, Berkshire Hathaway, in some ways, his company, bears a resemblance to the Rockefeller Empire that was assembled in the early part of the century. Warren's partner, Charlie Munger, has referred to him as an implacable acquirer, much like John D. Rockefeller, who stopped at nothing to put together the company that acquired steel business after steel business until it became this gargantuan enterprise. And Berkshire Hathaway bears some resemblance to that.
Maybe it's just that the public is just so confused and so lacking right now in figures they can trust that they're desperate to invest everything they have in this one hugely successful businessman. Maybe they're trying to invest too much in Warren Buffett.
What I've seen with Warren is that people like a very simple story of somebody who is grandfatherly and all-knowing, and they tend to see him as the father figure they wish they'd had. And I think in a time like this, when people are very worried, that gets squared and cubed and, you know, taken to a higher power.
Alice, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Alice Schroeder is the author of the new book, Snowball, Warren Buffett and the Business of Life. Give it up for Warren Buffett on the electric ukulele, courtesy of YouTube.
Up next, the man who would make newspapers louder.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. It's been quite the summer for Lee Abrams, the Tribune Company's senior vice president and first ever chief innovation officer. Over the past 6 months, Abrams has spearheaded redesigns at the Orlando Sentinel, the Baltimore Sun, the Chicago Tribune, and the Hartford Courant. He enjoyed many years of success in commercial and satellite radio, but he had never before worked in newspapers. However, now that he is, he's overflowing with ideas, ideas he often sends in the form of long, emphatic memos studded with all caps and exclamation points. Abrams says that today newspapers face competition from all media, TV, radio, and the Internet, and his job is to make all the ink-stained wretches in his employ understand that.
So I think a lot of it is really just trying to inspire people in the papers to really, without prejudice, evaluate where the paper's been, where it is now, and how to do the best possible version of it for 2008.
Well, your means of inspiration have substantially, although not entirely, been through your staff memos, sprinkled with all caps, words and phrases, and a kind of rah-rah style that journalists are destined to roll their eyes at or worse. In fact, it appears from just reading the blogosphere that some of your employees think that you're slightly unhinged. Are you slightly unhinged?
Maybe. I mean, if that's what it takes. They're really geared more to just get people thinking. Disagreeing is fine. Let's get a dialogue going here, because there are things I bring up that were sacred and certainly upset some people and just created all sorts of havoc.
Well, yeah. Permit me to cite one example. Your memo that suggested that special advertising sections, which are labeled as ads because they're ads, somehow be identified in a way that makes them less off-putting. Tell me why.
I was in Baltimore at Baltimore Sun and noticed they had some special sections that were about things like the environment, and I read them and they were great. But then all very prominently highlighted was special advertising section. And I think a lot of people would look at that and go, oh, just throw it out. It's a bunch of ads. Whereas it could be named something a little differently, a little more inventively, and still be clearly non-editorial, but just a little more engaging. And I think that's just one of those newspaperisms. You know, I've called it that for years. Special advertising section. Don't read me.
But Lee, it performs exactly the function that it's designed to perform. It tells the reader that this has nothing to do with the editorial processes of the newspaper. It does not bear its imprimatur. It offers none of the credibility that you've come to expect from the Chicago Tribune, Washington Post, what have you. That's why it's there. No?
No, I think some of the special advertising sections are just a series of ads. But some of them are actually very well written and informative, and I think it'll be better for the readers because there might be something in there they'd actually read. Certainly better for the advertisers. It'll get them more eyes.
There was another memo that made you the object of some ridicule internally when you expressed surprise that the Chicago Tribune actually had reporters on the ground in Baghdad. You thought that was undersold.
Absolutely. It was just so underplayed that it didn't register. You know, you watch television, and, you know, there's a guy reporting from Iraq, and there's missiles in the background, and it's obviously in a desert in Iraq, and you really get the feel they're taking you there. Whereas newspapers are so subtle about it, you'd think they'd have pictures of the reporters in the battle zone with Iraqi children or whatever. And it was actually in L.A. I was there just meeting with some people, and met with one of the reporters who just came back from years in Iraq and was talking to her, and she was telling me all these stories, you know, very vivid about being escorted by Marines and living in these special safe houses and all that, and it was fantastic. Then I looked at her stories, and they gave her really no credit. You know, I think it's important to push some of the values that newspapers have home a little harder, and that's one of them.
Well, one of the values of journalism traditionally has been to take the focus off of the reporter and onto the story that he or she is covering. But to see your memos, elsewhere I've seen this emphasis on more self-promotion, more blaring headlines, shorter stories, more hype. In short, a more tabloidish approach. Is that the way to save newspaper journalism, by making it louder?
I think it's important to figure out what people like and tell them about it unabashedly. I don't know if you've seen the Chicago Tribune. It's pretty dramatically different from what it was a month ago and louder, but it's, you know, very intelligent and well-written and compared to a typical tabloid. I mean, there's no comparison.
It's bolder without being vulgar, at least from the editions I've seen.
Exactly. And again, you know, the myth that if you do bolder things, oh, that means dumbing it down or making it a tabloid. I mean, that's, again, I just think one of those old newspaperisms that just isn't true.
One of the criticisms of the redesigned Chicago Tribune came from editor and publisher, who observed the following: for all the interesting navigation tools the Chicago Tribune has incorporated in its new design, the fact to keep remembering is that this makeover is intended not to be primarily, anyway, a newly reader-friendly paper, but one that can be put out cheaper with fewer hands and less editorial content.
That's typical of the whole newspaper business's point of view on any kind of change. I mean, I've never seen a business more negative. That article is just symbolic of that.
Isn't the industry negative not only because it's filled with cynical reporters and journalists, but because it is in free fall?
Well, you'd think if it was in free fall, there'd be more positive commitment to change, people trying things. It's amazing. The feedback we get is like, oh, my God, you guys are ruining these institutions, and I've never seen anything like it.
Do you not believe that the declining revenue and the constant cutbacks, the layoffs and buyouts and shrinkage of news holes and shift in ad edit ratios and all of the above aren't harming the editorial product?
Just look at the Chicago Tribune. I think it's as intelligent and deep as ever. And, you know, they've certainly had to cut back and make a lot of changes in that respect. I think that's a big excuse, in fact.
Will you join us again in 6 months' time? Whereupon I certainly hope that I can apologize to you for my negativism.
I would love to. 6 months, any time. And in 6 months, hopefully it'll have worked. If not, you know, at least give it a try. But pretty optimistic about it. But I'd love to talk to you in 6 months.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Lee Abrams is the Senior Vice President and Chief Innovation Officer at the Tribune Company. For Steve Smith, former editor of the Spokesman Review in Spokane, Washington, innovation didn't stop the decline of his paper. Since becoming editor in 2002, Smith worked hard to modernize the Spokesman Review. He streamed editorial meetings online and greatly expanded the online staff. The paper collaborated with an AM radio station and added a sound studio. And last December, Smith even cut the staff from 140 to 104. But when he was informed of another round of layoffs, including much of the online staff he'd recently hired, he refused. And last week, he resigned. He's been in the newspaper business for 36 years, and he's taken quite a few hits for quitting now. But he says he simply wasn't willing to impose more changes that he felt would harm the paper irreparably.
The layoff list includes our entire radio staff and a good chunk of our online staff. And so pioneering, advancing, innovating would become very, very difficult, if not impossible.
And what about beats or projects?
We'd gone from three public safety reporters to one, four education reporters to one half of a higher ed reporter, a reporter covering both Spokane City Hall and Spokane County Government. And the ability to do the kind of watchdog investigative journalism which has been our hallmark is severely diminished. Not eliminated. There are some fabulous journalists left in Spokane, but you just can't stretch that size staff across our coverage area and maintain anything close to the coverage we've been providing.
Let me talk to you briefly about your relationship with your management. They understand that they have to have a credible newspaper if they're going to have a credible business going forward, and yet they imposed these cuts. And at what point do you feel some sympathy for them?
Oh, I feel tremendous sympathy for them. My parting with my publisher, Stacy Coles, was quite amicable. I don't agree that these cuts are necessary at this time, but I understand and respect his decision to the contrary. And frankly, one of the reasons that I resigned is that he needs an editor who can stand up in public and say to people, this paper is going to be okay, actually better than okay, leaner, easier to read, etc. And I was not in a position to carry out the publisher's marketing strategy.
Do you think that there is any paper anywhere in the United States that is immune to these forces that so affected the Spokesman Review? Is there any place for you or anyone else to really make a go of it in the way newsmen have made a go of it since time immemorial?
It's absolutely not going to be like it was. It never can be. What I try to emphasize is that the values that are at the core of our calling, the Fourth Estate value, the defending the defenseless value, the telling people what we know when we know it value, holding up and honoring and perpetuating those core values ought now to be our mission. I'm not out to save newspapers. It may not be possible to save newspapers, but it ought to be possible to save journalism.
Okay, you want to support journalistic values. How and where are you going to be able to do God's work?
Well, I might end up at another news organization, which will give me a platform to prove my ideas and my theories in practice. I suppose I could end up in a foundation world or the academic world. I may be doing it as a private citizen through blogging and speaking out. I would suspect that I'm probably persona non grata to most publishers in the United States, so maybe it won't involve newspapers, but I have no intention from leaving the scene.
You know, there's something vaguely un-American in giving up. Aren't we all supposed to stick with it, fight against the most imposing obstacles, and if necessary, just go down with the ship?
Well, that's absolutely true, and I've been hearing a lot of that. There are folks who think that I cut and ran. I think the question is your loyalty to journalism, is your commitment to trying to find a new way, or is your commitment to a particular organization, a particular newspaper, and a particular ownership? I don't think you serve journalism well by staying with an organization which has decided that it cannot commit to our future.
All right, Steve. Well, thank you very much, and best of luck to you.
Thank you very much, Bob. I really appreciate it.
Steve Smith was, until last week, the editor of the Spokane Spokesman Review. Nowadays, most of TV's talking heads are economic analysts or political pundits. But in the run-up to war and in the first 2 years of fighting, those chairs were filled with former military officers. Remember these names?
Lieutenant Colonel Bill Cowan is a retired U.S. Marine and a Fox News military analyst.
Welcome back to Harbaugh. While the political battle over Iraq, the war funding, and the troop withdrawal issues heat up, General Barry McCaffrey just got back from Iraq.
And we're joined now in our studio by Major General Robert Scales, one of NPR's military consultants.
This week, the Federal Communications Commission said it is investigating, as the New York Times reported last spring, whether many of those talking heads had been coached and even subsidized by the Pentagon. Were the networks and their audiences duped by wolves in civilian clothing? Were the Pentagon surrogates further compromised by undisclosed ties to military contractors enriching themselves in Iraq? Last spring, we spoke to one of the analysts named by the Times, Major Robert Bevilacqua, a former Green Beret and Fox News contributor through 2005. Bevilacqua had his first sit-down with the Pentagon brass in 2003.
And, of course, I'm the lowest-ranking guy in the room because I'm a former major, and the majority of the folks there were retired generals, some 3 stars, 2 stars, basically the whole Milky Way. Large oblong table and a packet which contained slides and general information or talking points, if you will, that the Pentagon wanted to use. The intent was obvious. It was to give us the party line so we would at least have it and know it verbatim. Of course, at no time did they say, guys, this is what you got to say when you get on the air.
Although in the Times, you're quoted as saying, it was them saying, we need to stick our hands up your back and move your mouth for you. How long before you figured that out?
That became obvious for me after my trip back from Iraq in October of 2003. Having spent a month on the ground and then going back to one of these sessions, it became obvious to me that they really didn't know what was happening in Iraq. And they weren't interested in telling the reality of the situation on the ground to the American people. They were going back to their standard talking points. And from what I saw on the ground, it was a full-blown insurgency, and this was in 2003. And that's when I started referring it to as the Kool-Aid session, and I no longer participated.
Now, were you hired by Fox to give an independent analysis of the situation in Iraq from a Green Beret's point of view?
I was a Desert Storm veteran, so I knew mechanized tactics. I knew special operations tactics. I had been on the ground in Iraq. So for me not to be commentating on the war was ridiculous. So naturally, I just fell into that role.
What kind of reception did you get from the Fox hosts when you did not parrot more or less what the Pentagon was telling you?
I was called into one individual's office following my trip from Iraq to do a debriefing in which I was asked my opinion. After giving my opinion, it was basically jammed back down my throat. I didn't know what the hell I was talking about.
This was a Fox News host who told you didn't know what you were talking about?
It's a pretty senior individual that has his own show. And where I really became uncomfortable was my analysis would get questioned because it didn't fit a certain party line. And that, for me, I have some serious issues with that. And I got to tell you, you know, I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat. I'm extremely independent. I voted in one presidential election in my life because I thought I had a choice, and that was for Ross Perot. So I don't like being jabbed on either side or labeled as conservative or liberal. I try and play it down the middle of the road, and that's where my analysis went, down the middle of the road. And it just so happened to be on the wrong side.
Now, in the Times, the piece makes clear that there were swirling conflicts of interest. There was the relationship between the Pentagon and the supposedly independent analysts of the war. There was also the relationship between the analysts and their other employers, in many cases, military contractors. How did that figure into the dynamic of what was said on television and what was not said?
You know, I can only speak for myself. I can't speak for other folks other than what I heard, overheard in the green room, and that was folks expressing concern about airing an opinion that may adversely affect them while at work. At the time, I was working for a mid-sized firm that did have some DOD contracts, and I had the owner of that company flat out tell me, you need to be careful what you say in the air. Never say anything contradictory about George Bush because it could affect us. I quit 2 weeks later.
The Times story is kind of horrifying on the face of it, and we've discussed what it had right. Was there anything that David Barstow got wrong?
Yeah, David Barstow forgot that there was human beings with blood flowing through their veins that got behind the camera. To come out and say that they were all puppets and that they all promulgated information, whether they agreed with it or not, is not very accurate. And is it any mystery that a room filled with conservative men that spent their life serving their country probably would support an administrative position on going to war? So he missed, for me, he missed that human component of the story.
Well, Bob, thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Take care.
Robert Bevilacqua is a former Green Beret and a former military analyst for Fox News. We spoke to him last April. When we called him this week, he said he had not yet been summoned by investigators at the FCC, but he did have a recent sit-down with the Department of Defense Inspector General's office, which is conducting its own investigation at the behest of Congress of the Talking Heads controversy. He said he wasn't allowed to say more.
Coming up, ads so subtle we can't see them even when we're looking right at them.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Center at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Free TV has never been exactly free. Viewers have always paid for their programming by sitting through the commercials, at least until recently when TiVos and other digital devices have made it easier to skip past ads altogether. Thus, in the last 7 or 8 years, advertisers have insinuated themselves more and more into the content itself. This week saw the first annual so-called Branded Entertainment Awards, awards built around TV shows and films so saturated with consumer products as to be positively un-TiVo-able. Emily Nussbaum wrote about this collision of ads and art for this week's New York Magazine. She says that once product placement was clumsy, laughable, tacky, and sad. Most viewers saw it from a mile away. But now the products are not so much placed as thoroughly integrated. And what's worse, they're turning up on her favorite shows.
That doesn't mean that that scene doesn't go beautifully well and doesn't completely match the plot. But it does remove the possibility of the writers taking different turns in the future, for instance, saying negative things about the brand.
You're not the only one concerned about this. The FCC is at least considering the idea of forcing networks to run disclaimers that say, you know, this is not a TV show, it's a program-length commercial.
That's right. The proposal has come from the Writers Guild. Essentially, what they're suggesting is something that probably will strike many TV viewers as really sort of shocking and outrageous. If there's a product integration on the show, they want a banner to run concurrently with those lines underneath the show, saying basically, this scene brought to you by Snapple. One thing they're concerned about is that television writers not be forced by networks to become copywriters and add references to products in their stories if they don't want to. They're also concerned that writers get paid for it if there's extra money coming in having to do with brands. So it's basically, if you're going to do it, we want money for it.
This is an outrage. And by the way, the money is terrible.
At the same time, I mean, I'm sympathetic with the WGA's desire on both those parts.
Can you give me some examples of some of the more Byzantine efforts to get the brand name before the viewer's face?
30 Rock is a fantastically written show. I think it's brilliant television. And it's a show about television, which makes it all the more complicated. One of the things I talked about in the piece was the efforts on the part of the brand Soyjoy to place their brand in 30 Rock, which they successfully did.
What's going on with you?
The season finale of MILF Island, and I'm going to watch alone in my office.
That's pretty grim, Pete.
Oh, a dangler. Liz, I'm going to get free food.
Wow.
It's Soyjoy. Who doesn't love Soyjoy? I'm stuck!
And 30 Rock was about a fictional reality show called MILF Island. But there was a subplot when one of the characters got his arm caught in a snack machine. And essentially, he was reaching for a Soyjoy. And I have to say, as a regular viewer of 30 Rock, I watched this and I thought, Soyjoy, what a funny name. I assumed it was a made-up product. They often have made-up products on the show. And during the scene, they ran this slogan for Soyjoy.
Stay tuned for one final shocking twist. Brought to you by Soyjoy, fortified with optimism.
I was watching a product placement within a show about a show, MILF Island, that was a reality show that had a product that was a sponsor on the show. One of the things that is that when people talk about product integration is they often talk about reality television. Reality television is stuffed from top to bottom with product placement. Right from the beginning, the kids on The Real World would go, hey, I've got a text message on my T-Mobile. You know, it was right there. That does not bother me. What bothers me is the larger repercussions of that, because reality television is such a great economic bargain for TV networks that it's easy to get a lot of sponsors to sponsor them because they can show their products right up there. And on top of that, they're very cheap to make. This has really put the squeeze on scripted shows to integrate products.
Well, a perfect example is in 30 Rock, where they did a joke. I guess they can only do this joke once, but it's, as you describe it, hilarious and brilliant and ironic and subversive. Can you tell me about the Verizon placement?
Tina Fey, the character she's playing, Liz Lemon, is meeting with her boss. She's trying to pry into his personal life.
Are you all right?
Well, last night I... Never mind. These Verizon wireless phones are just so popular, I accidentally grabbed one belonging to an acquaintance.
Well, sure, because that Verizon wireless service is just unbeatable. I mean, if I saw a phone like that on TV, I would be like, where is my nearest retailer so I can get one? Can we have our money now?
I love that joke. I really did think it was funny. But it's only over time that I've started having this real sinking feeling about it, because it's potentially the ruination of television. Call me a naive, goofy hippie, but I feel like as a viewer, you almost have to make a choice about being completely gulled and credulous or being utterly suspicious.
Some TV comedy is so sort of postmodern and so thick with cultural references. You know, I'm thinking of actually Seinfeld and episodes about Junior Mints and eating Snickers bars with a knife and fork. But, I don't believe they were product placements, and yet they were bizarrely product-centric. No money changed hands.
You're right. It wasn't the same economic situation. And there are other shows that did this with incredible skill, like Sex and the City, where the characters themselves were such rabid consumers that it made complete sense. The contemporary way of doing this is to do it in a way that's both overt and satirical, as on 30 Rock and as with Stephen Colbert, who does jokes about product integration with Doritos while being paid by Doritos.
Cannibalism. It might actually be the future. If so, I am proud to announce that my 2012 presidential coverage will be sponsored by Sour Cream and Man-Flavored Doritos. Put some man in your mouth!
I'm of two minds about this because these are, again, some of my favorite television creators. However, it sedates people and makes it feel okay, because if you feel like you're in on the joke, it feels like there's nothing wrong with it. And, you know, maybe that's true of the Verizon joke and of the Doritos joke, but I'm not sure that it's true of the next 10 jokes.
You have something particular in mind when you say what the next step could be, because we've actually seen it foreshadowed on 30 Rock.
Well, I remember the first time that I was watching these because, like many people, I don't tend to watch ads on television. I TiVo through them. But, of course, if you're TiVoing through and then you see the characters from the show, you think the show has started again. Well, I stopped my TiVo and I realized, of course, that it wasn't 30 Rock. It was an ad for American Express featuring characters from 30 Rock. And the goal is to get viewers to do exactly what I did, which is to stop TiVoing through the ads. It's an extremely clever technique. I applaud advertisers for doing it. At the same time, I think it's terrible. And I actually would like to point out, we're talking about television, and I think television is in many ways the most important thing to talk about with this, because it's a big mass art form. It's at a really crucial jumping off point right now, economically and artistically. But it's not the only art form that uses product integration. There are theater shows on Broadway that feature product integration. I mentioned one in the piece, Sweet Charity, changed one of their lyrics and served a certain kind of rum in the lobby in order to match this. There was a book written by the British writer Faye Weldon that was sponsored by Bulgari. And I think when people think about the ethics of this, which are definitely complex, and I'm not saying are as simple as saying, like, this is bad, this is corrupted, but I think people should actually compare it to other forms and think to themselves, if I knew that every time that Ian McEwan's characters drank a Coke, it was because Coca-Cola had paid him an enormous amount of money, how would that affect my thoughts about the book? I think it's useful for people to make these comparisons, because I think that otherwise we essentially just let it happen without ever thinking about it. And I think that that's the most dangerous thing.
Well, Emily, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Emily Nussbaum is an editor-at-large for New York Magazine. Her piece, What Would Tina Fey Do for a Soy Joy, is in the October 13th issue of the magazine.
There's been a lot of coverage of the attempts by Obama opponents to convince voters that he's a Muslim. Journalists have fact-checked that assertion and reported that the, quote, smear isn't true, he's not a Muslim. But according to a report published by the liberal media watchdog group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, there's a presumption underlying that whole discussion that has become an accepted part of the reporting, that being Muslim is, in fact, a smear, an insult, a charge to be vigorously fended off. Steve Rendell is a senior analyst at Fair. Steve, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's great to be on, Brooke.
So a portion of your study is called Secret Muslims Open Bigotry, and it focuses on the idea that no one's talking much about that unspoken notion that being a Muslim is, you know, bad. Do you have any examples of the media inadvertently playing into that message?
Well, Brooke, we have the New York Times and ABC News calling it a smear, as if there were something suspicious or bad about being a Muslim if it were true. If a charge came out that a politician was a secret Jew, that story would be treated as a story about, first, a false charge, but also as a story about anti-Semitism. And how do we know this? We know this because in 1990 in Poland, the Roman Catholic incumbent running for prime minister was targeted by a whispering campaign claiming that he was a secret Jew. There was all sorts of umbrage taken in American newspapers. Richard Cohen wrote about it and said it was a peculiar virus of Poland. And we had the Atlanta Journal-Constitution weighing in saying, whew, it's good we're not like that. As it turns out, it's not that peculiar a virus.
Can we talk about political realities here? Maybe the unspoken assumption isn't that being a Muslim is bad, but that it is a clear political liability. On top of that, there have been millions of emails glutting mailboxes every day saying that not only is he a Muslim, but he's a double agent ready to deliver the country into the hands of terrorists. So, isn't calling it a smear merely an acknowledgement of the fact that if he were believed to be a Muslim, then this would destroy his chances of becoming president?
I think you summed it up perfectly. It does present a special problem for journalists. Journalists must deal with the fact of the matter. One, Barack Obama is not, in fact, a Muslim. Two, there's nothing wrong with being a Muslim. And three, getting to the bottom of that bigotry, doing stories about how it is that we've got to 2008 and being considered a Muslim might destroy somebody's chances of being elected.
In terms of asking a reporter to say, no, he's not a Muslim, and by the way, being a Muslim isn't a bad thing, I mean, what do you do? Do you just tack on the Seinfeldian, he's not a Muslim, not that there's anything wrong with that?
Well, that's putting it a little bit flippantly. I think what we'd point out is that double standard, again, that if somebody was being accused of being a secret Jew, we'd have a discussion not only of the fact of the matter, we'd also have a discussion of the underlying anti-Semitism in that campaign. The second part is not happening in this case. And our report is not just a matter of talking about how the media sometimes miss the ball on this. It's also talking about how the media often abet this Islamophobia. We have, for instance, in the last couple of years, Bruce Bauer's book, While Europe Slept, was nominated for a National Book Critics Circle Award. Now, two members of the board protested that nomination of an explicitly Islamophobic, bigoted book smearing an entire religious group. In the last couple of years, Mark Steyn had a explicitly Islamophobic book on the New York Times bestseller list, and Robert Spencer had two. So we have this rising tide of Islamophobia and very little being done to confront it on the part of journalists.
So in your report, you identify 12 pundits who are the leading teachers of anti-Muslim bigotry, in the words of the report. On the list, Michelle Malkin, Sean Hannity, Bill O'Reilly, Michael Savage. I mean, Michael Savage? I mean, this is a who's who of people who make a living insulting every group that's out there. More importantly, they're preaching to the choir. Do you have any evidence that these guys are having any impact outside of the echo chambers in which they dwell?
Well, let me first address the idea that they're bigots towards everyone. We document Michael Savage in this report calling for the killing of 100 million Muslims. We have Bill O'Reilly saying that Iraqis are, they're all Muslims. They're just doing what they're doing. They're killing each other and killing Americans. As far as they're just preaching to the choir, I think the fact that these people that we name, these 12 here, several of them, Glenn Beck, Hannity, Pat Robertson, O'Reilly, Savage, have national media perches. These people, in some of these cases, are actually sponsored by big national media conglomerates. And the other people named often appear in this same media spouting this notion that Muslims have a secret plan to take over the world, which echoes back to the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. So there's some very strong similarities here with the history of anti-Semitism. And I think these are some of the things that we want journalists to not just no longer abet, but to actually explore and expose.
Steve, thank you very much.
Oh, it's great to be here, Brooke.
Steve Rendell is a senior analyst at FAIR. In the minds of many Americans, anti-Muslim sentiment is all of a piece with anti-Arab sentiment, especially after 9/11. Last year, we spoke with actor Sayed Bedreya, who bemoaned getting only villainous roles, and he told us he felt this frustration most keenly when he was working at his craft.
I used to sit on the set and look at the movie star and the hero and everything, and I said, why not for one day I can be a hero? Why not for one day I can have the girl?
Bedreya was a kid growing up in Egypt in the time of the Six-Day War when he was seduced by American movies. When he said he was going Hollywood, his friends said he was crazy. But he did. He was a handsome Arab actor. In America, there were no parts for handsome Arab actors, so he grew a beard, put on some weight.
Then when I went to the audition, I was angry, and they said, this is what we're looking for. This is the real thing.
Can you tell me about some of the bad guy roles that you played in the 80s and 90s?
Well, I hijacked an aeroplane in executive decision. I blew up places in True Lies. I kidnapped people. I done everything bad.
So he worked, though his parts found little favor in the Arab-American community. Then, not long ago, his friend Peter Farrelly, yes, of the infamous Farrelly brothers, told him it was time to produce something from his heart. So Bedreya made American East, a film about an Arab-American family man who opens up a restaurant with his best friend, who's Jewish. The friend is played by Tony Shalhoub. The goal, the depiction of ordinary men.
Kids. I don't want my kids to change his name from Muhammad to Michael because the Arab image is bad. No, I want him to have his name, Muhammad. And Muhammad doesn't mean terrorist. Hollywood had to learn we are American. It happened to be Arab. We are American because we choose to come to this country. What is America? I grew up in a ghetto and I end up in Hollywood doing movie with movie star George Clooney and all this stuff. That's America. It gives you the dream, but you have to work for it.
Here's the kicker. Come Friday, you can see Sayed Bedreya in a new part. He appears in Oliver Stone's much-anticipated presidential biopic, W. He's playing, you guessed it, Saddam Hussein.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh and Bill Bowen. We also had help from Michael Bernstein,
Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Brooke, say W again.
W.
On the Media is supported by the School of Visual Arts, hosting an information session for their new program, Master of Fine Arts in Social Documentary Film, on November 8th at the New York campus. More at mfasocdoc.sva.edu. Support for On the Media also comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.